It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad. Republican state senators meet tomorrow in extraordinary session to pass legislation to rewrite campaign finance laws and reconfigure the state's elections agency. WPR state government reporter Sean Johnson joins us now with the latest. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, the state assembly passed a couple of bills along party lines. It's taken a little time now in the Senate. There was a little drama. Tell us what the Senate objected to, or Republican senators in particular, in the assembly legislation we've seen.
Yeah, this thing looked, I guess both these bills looked like they were on the fast track, that they were going to pass without much drama. And then there were some Republican senators who didn't like what they were seeing with them. I think still to this moment, we're not sure exactly what changes are going to be in those bills tomorrow, but we're getting an idea that senators had issues with the way that the bills would reconfigure Wisconsin's Government Accountability Board. The assembly bill basically blows it up, creates two new commissions, one for elections, one for ethics. And some senators had issues with the campaign finance bill, which is basically a rewrite of all of our campaign finance laws. Specifically, they had issues with the way that the assembly bill would let donors keep their employer's secret.
Let's take each of those in turn now. Let's start with the GAB, the Government Accountability Board. It would be split, as you say, into two. It would have partisan appointees instead of these retired judges. So the Senate gets a look at that. What didn't they like about the composition of those boards?
What they didn't like, or at least what a handful of them didn't like, is that if you have these boards with partisan appointees, three Democrats and three Republicans, suddenly you've got a model that's very much like the Federal Elections Commission, the FEC, where nothing gets done, where you have gridlock all the time because you're at a standoff between Republicans and Democrats. So it sounds like, and again, we haven't seen the bill, but it sounds like what Senator Luther Olson, among others, have added to the bill is that there will be a couple judges on the board. So right now, the Government Accountability Board is run by six retired judges. They're all appointed by the governor. In this new model, you would have two judges added to these other partisan appointees. The catch is, I guess, one of them would be appointed by Republicans, and one of them would be appointed by Democrats. So, you know, that makeup might make them want to reach decisions that please the parties that nominated them. But it is, you know, I guess Senator Luther Olson feels like it's a better situation than you had before. And in his mind, it would get rid of some of that gridlock that he was worried you were going to see in the old model.
The assembly passed this legislation without the judges on that committee. The Senate could conceivably tomorrow pass it with. So then it's a legislative ping pong, goes back to the assembly. What have we been hearing from assembly leaders on this whole judge issue?
I don't think it's a huge change. I mean, it sounds like assembly leaders are willing to go along with this. And in fact, they were willing to put that in an earlier version of the bill. So it's, you know, I think at its core, the bill is pretty close to what passed the assembly. For example, another big change that nobody's talking about changing in the Senate is that right now our Government Accountability Board has an independent funding stream. It's what's known as sum sufficient in state government, where they have as much money as they need to pursue investigations, take the investigations wherever they lead them, and not have to worry about funding. That is going to be gone under the bill that passes the Senate, which means that if an investigation becomes expensive, goes over $25,000, the investigators would have to ask the legislature for more money. So you can imagine that could be an awkward situation. If they're investigating legislators, for example, they might have to go before those same legislators and ask for extra money to continue.
Talking to WPR state government reporter Sean Johnson about some election-related legislation passed the assembly in the Senate, maybe getting some changes. Let's turn to the campaign finance side of this. This is the one that a lot of Democrats had recused themselves from voting on when this was in the assembly, I think. Right, Sean?
They did. All Democrats voted. They recused themselves from that vote. So you got to think about the situation in the assembly. Republicans have a 63-36 majority there, which means they can basically do what they want. And so for Democrats, it's kind of a matter of How do you express your disapproval with the agenda that's getting steamrolled through there? And the way that they chose to do it is they all abstained. They said that I don't feel like I can vote on this because we are changing the rules for campaign finance that will affect my campaign committees in the middle of this term. That is, it's going to affect the upcoming election. And we shouldn't be doing that. We should wait to make these changes, or we should delay these changes until, you know, after a new legislature is sworn in. So they all sat out of the vote. And, you know, while Republicans did call it a gimmick and said they're well within their right to make these changes, that if a legislature doesn't make these changes, who will? It did make them squirm a little bit, and they were... It definitely got them to the floor to defend the changes.
This campaign finance legislation does a lot. We've talked about it on the show, but the sticking point, as you mentioned, is this disclosure of who's making donations directly to a candidate's campaign, right?
Yeah, so right now you're supposed to put who your employer is when you donate to campaigns. Doesn't always happen, is the thing. So that is that's something that Assembly Republicans took out. They were going to say you no longer have to report your employer when you contribute to political candidates. It sounds like, and again, we don't have the bill, but it sounds like Senate Republicans are going to put that piece back into the bill. But, you know, that aside, there are some much larger changes to Wisconsin campaign finance law. They're going to have, you know, much larger repercussions for years to come that are going to remain in that bill.
And this is an extraordinary session. They would have had to get it done today, I guess, to be in the regular session. Does that change how this gets treated, public input, that sort of thing?
It gives the majority power more power to move an agenda without having to worry about Democrats objecting. So Democrats can't block this stuff if some Republican lawmakers don't help them and vote no, but Democrats can, you know, for example, a parliamentary move, object to third reading or object to messaging it over to the Senate or to the Assembly, just slow its passage. So an extraordinary session lets them come in basically whenever they want and lets them move without having to worry about the minority party.
As we wrap up, Sean, is there a timeline? Are we expecting to come out of tomorrow with the Senate having passed something?
Yeah, I don't know how quickly they're going to do it, but I don't think they would convene if they didn't think that they could get the votes. The Assembly is going to be back in on Monday and presumably agree to these changes, and the governor has given every indication that he will sign them.
Sean, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
We've been talking to Sean Johnson, WPR's state government reporter. He's at the Capitol discussing the extraordinary session Senate Republicans are taking up tomorrow to try and pass legislation that would rewrite campaign finance laws here in Wisconsin and reshape the state's elections agency. Cartoonist, novelist, and creative dynamo Linda Berry has a national reputation for her award-winning book, What It Is, and before that for being the creator of Ernie Pook's Comique, featuring the characters Marlis and Freddie.
These days, she says if she had to choose between sitting down and talking to the most famous, celebrated, an accomplished adult in the world, and a kid, she'd choose the kid every time. She's an art professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, but she spends a lot of her time helping kids dig into the art of drawing.
Lately, she's been working with kids at the Children's Museum in Madison, where she's collaborated with and been inspired by the way children think about the world and how they draw it on paper. Her new exhibit there is called Drawing Fast and Slow, the comp book art of Linda Berry. It's the first exhibit of Berry's work to appear outside of New York, and it's on display in the community concourse at the Madison Children's Museum through the end of January.
Earlier this week, Linda Berry sat down with Veronica Rickert to talk about her new exhibit, why she loves hanging out with kids, and the creative process.
I want to start by asking you about a quote from one of your pieces at the Madison Children's Museum. You've got a new exhibit there, and I'm going to describe it a little bit because this is radio. It's a pop box with a cat sleeping on it, and the quote within the box reads, "At the center of everything we call the arts and children call play is something that seems somehow alive." Can you explain a little bit more about what you think is alive in that artistic play space?
I'd like to talk about how this use of this thing that I'm calling alive, we start to do it before we can even talk, and the best way to explain it is this idea of a kid getting attached to a toy or a blanket. So we'll say, we'll give an example of a blanket. So we know the blanket's not alive, right? You and I know the blanket's not alive. The kid has the feeling that the blanket is alive, and eventually the whole family recognizes that the blanket has some kind of life. It's not alive in the way you and I are alive, but it, if you said, is the blanket dead? You know, no, the blanket's not dead. The blanket's not alive. The blanket's not dead. The blanket's something in between. And that typifies to me images in the image world and the arts. You know, when you think of Scrooge, is he alive? Well, no. Is he dead? No. He's something else. He's in the image world. So that's what I'm talking about. It's this aliveness where the thing that you're playing with seems to be able to play back.
Mm. Well, you've been working with kids who do a lot of playing and drawing of images. You've been working with kids at the Madison Children's Museum. And I know this is a labor of love for you. What kinds of things have you been doing with the kids there?
Well, one of the things that I've been doing is I've been trying to find a space where my students at the University of Wisconsin can work with kids, and I'm there to kind of facilitate it because. One, for in my own experience, it's always been an interaction with a kid that's gotten me out of any kind of creative jam. And so I wanted to make that available to my students. And I also am really concerned about the fact that in our modern life, kids don't interact with other adults who they're either not related to or haven't been vetted in this strong way. So is there a place that's safe for them to talk to strangers? Hmm. And one of the best things to do when you're talking to strangers is not just talk, but build something together. So the show at the Madison Children's Museum is a show of some of the, you know, those composition notebooks with the marble covers, those black and white ones? So I've been keeping those since I was 19 and I'm 60.
And you got one in front of you right now.
Yeah, I keep them with me all the time. And so I do about 12 a year. So you can imagine how many I have. It's a tower. It's taller than I am. And so the museum is showing some of those comp books. And I wanted to do something so that I could get the kids at the museum and my students to work together to make these comp books, because there's something about just gluing stuff onto paper and writing down stuff and drawing together that is a good kind of interaction that I feel like is really missing from the modern world, particularly for kids. And I also notice with my students, so my students are in their maybe 19 to in their 20s, they don't really know how to use scissors. They have a difficult time. They don't know how to use a ruler. Like if you ask them to take a 9x12 piece of paper and make it 8.5x11 and you give them a ruler and some scissors, there's this terrified look. And so I'm curious about what's going to happen to our hands and our ability to work together. And also I got really interested when I came to the university about why grad students were so miserable. And why that was so acceptable. And I wondered if getting grad students together with pre-K kids as co-researchers on their dissertations and their thesis, I did this for a year, would make a difference.
And did it?
Yeah, absolutely. Just in terms of the disposition toward the world. And I found that when people who are working on very difficult academic problems actually work with kids and ask them questions or play with them, it's as if you can borrow that state of mind. And that state of mind is essential to discovery and intuition, this odd, open state of mind. For instance, I had a mathematician, a grad student, who was contemplating what numbers were, and we were around some kids, and he goes, for example, what's 5? And this kid goes, I'm 5. So it's that kind of stuff, you know, and see how you laughed and how I laughed. And so something happened when we just laughed at that. It wasn't like, oh, it's not just, oh, how sweet. I would imagine that there's an immune system boost. There's a stress reduction. So I think all this stuff actually is tied together and has something to do with not just our mental health, but our physical health as well.
So the kids are helping the formerly miserable grad students. What do the kids get out of interacting with adults that you were saying you think this is missing in our society? The kids don't get to interact with non-vetted grown-ups. What do the kids get about talking to these grad students?
Well, for one thing, they get students who aren't talking to them as if they're children, You know how people talk to kids and how they read everything in this sort of voice that just makes you go nuts? So there are actual conversations, sort of deep conversations, and the kids draw along with my students. We do a thing called tandem drawing where two people will be drawing simultaneously. One's the leader, and then the other one turns into the leader, so your hand moves like a Ouija board, kind of. The kids tell my students stories, and the students write them down, and then they draw the pictures. So in the end, the kid gets a little, you know, gets little books or gets their stories written down. So they start to think of themselves as writers and artists, even though they might not have those words. So it's a real, when the program ended, it was called Drawbridge. You know, there was a lot of just sadness about missing each other. I miss the kids I worked with, and I know my students miss the kids they worked with, and vice versa.
We're talking with artist and cartoonist and author Linda Berry right now on Central Time. She has a new exhibit at the Madison Children's Museum. And it seems as though some of the pieces you have on exhibit use an image that a kid has drawn, and then you take your spin on it on the adjacent page. And there's one of it's like a celestial squid or an octopus. And you're asking kids to use what you call an ordinary superpower, to put themselves into a different place or time or situation. Can you talk a little bit more about what you think that ordinary superpower is and why it matters?
Well, the ordinary superpower is the power to make a story. Just make a story out of, like if you sit down with a kid and you say, let's make a story, nothing really happens. But if you say, I have a story about a rabbit, and I know that the rabbit encounters a fire, but I don't know where. And the kid will tell you. And you start to build this world, and by the time you're done, it's as if that world already existed. So that's an ordinary superpower to me. And also drawing. Drawing, if I could just unhitch drawing from the pulling the cart of art and fine art, if I could just take it and put it where it belongs, which is in language, it's a language. And so it's a language in that, say, you and I can't speak, but if I want some coffee, I can draw a cup of coffee with a question mark next to it and hold it up to you and you'd know coffee. And it turns out that people, once they stop trying to draw beautifully, they discover they can speak this other language. And kids already can speak that language. They lose it. They lose it around, about 8 or 9. It's getting younger and younger because they don't use their hands as much anymore. But it actually is a language. And this language facilitates all sorts of things in terms of, again, intuition and discovery, which I think are the most important things.
So it's interesting, just to go back, you said you want to unhinge the cart of drawing from art. And here you are, you're working in the art department at the university. Is there a case to be made that it is still art, or do you think what do you think is going on that it's seen as a language?
Well, it is still art, but the problem with art is at a certain age, people only think only artists can do art. And the people that I work with at the university, so my title is assistant professor in interdisciplinary creativity.
Very impressive.
So which my husband calls me Professor Long Title. So for me, writing is a strong component of the work that we do. It's more along the lines of comics and cartoons. So it is within the art department, but I recruit heavily from other areas of the university, and my best classes are ones that are mixed with people from the hard sciences and the soft sciences and, you know, all around the university.
I want to ask you about one of my favorite pieces as we wrap up here. There's a picture of a chicken made out of cotton balls, some glue. I imagine there's some scissors involved in there at some point. And here's the quote. It says, "Sometimes in life, when we are very sad, it is good to make a chicken in winter. It is not a beautiful chicken, but it is a chicken that will guard you through the hours and hours quietly." Tell me about that winter chicken piece.
Well, you know, when people get stuck and really depressed, one of the things that they do is they either just get on the internet and flip around, like, you know, they remind me of gamblers, because it is like gambling. Maybe this time I'll score and find something interesting.
Like pulling the lever on a slot machine.
Yeah, or they sit very still. But I've found that if I can even get people to just tear up pieces of paper and glue, draw a quick shape of a chicken, tear up a bunch of paper or cotton balls and just start to glue them down, there's some other state of mind that comes about. And it's a, like a different system in the brain that seems to address. It doesn't cure the depression, but you do feel like you have company. Like I call that my service chicken. You know, they have people have service animals. So this is my service chicken. So there's just something about doing something with our hands, the original digital devices, that has everything to do with being able to help ourselves out of the normal human jams we all run into.
Linda, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. It's so good to see you. And I want to say hello to everybody out there in Wisconsin land as a badger.
That was cartoonist, novelist, and UW-Madison art professor Linda Berry talking with Veronica Rickert. Berry's new exhibit called Drawing Fast and Slow is on display now in the community concourse area at the Madison Children's Museum.
This week is the one-year anniversary of the death of Brittany Maynard. Maynard was in her late 20s when she was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer. Over the course of her illness, she went public with her journey and her belief that the right to end-of-life aid should be legal. She moved from her home in Northern California to the state of Oregon, one of only five states that allowed aid in dying at that time.
Shortly after Maynard's death, a Harris poll found that 75% of Americans believe that people who are terminally ill have the right to choose to end their own life. Today, there's legislation for end-of-life options in over 20 states. George Amy joins us now. He's the president of the Death with Dignity National Center based in Oregon. George, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for the opportunity.
So it's been a year since the very public passing of Brittany Maynard, who moved to Oregon so she could have legal assistance in ending her life. What's changed in that year?
A great deal. First of all, the movement was going forward very slowly, but when Brittany Maynard's story came out, it was apparent that she hit a chord in the opinion of so many Americans and actually in the world. She was a young, attractive woman, articulate, intelligent, and determined to make certain that her decision with regard to how her life would end would be her decision and no one else's. So her impact had a significant impact on the passage in California in particular, and now in other states where we're seeing legislative bodies considering enacting the similar type bills, the Oregon model.
And underneath that legislation is public opinion. How have you seen the public's attitude toward this issue of aid in dying change over the last year or so?
Well, the last year or so, we were having polls in the neighborhood of, well, in Oregon, of course, it was the highest in the nation because we've had it for 18 years. But throughout the United States, it was around 55 to 65, and now it's 70-75%. Throughout the nation that we're seeing polls. In Oregon, it's around 80% now. So it has had an impact. There's no question about it because people have become more aware of this option. And I think it's a combination also of the aging of the baby boomers who are seeing their own parents die and also facing their inevitable demise. And they're saying, you know, I want this option. And so it's becoming more acceptable as long as there are safeguards and protections within the law.
So you said that Brittany's passing and her advocacy leading up to that had a big effect in California because she moved from California to Oregon to be able to take advantage of the legislation in place in the, in your state. How much impact do you think she has had across the nation, not just, you know, on the Pacific Coast?
Well, there's no question. We're working now in several other East Coast states and a couple Midwest states, and it's definitely her story resonates with legislators and with their constituents. And so it is having that positive an impact. I think we're reaching that point where the critical mass, the tipping point in this particular social movement is occurring within the next couple of years at least.
We're talking to George Amy with the national organization Death with Dignity about aid in dying, terminal patients legally being able to end their own lives with some sort of assistance in some cases. George, one concern that's been brought up as this issue has been debated across the country is that people might feel in some way pressured to end their own lives, that if they were seen as a burden to their family or saw themselves, for that matter, as a burden to their family, that they would be pressured to end their own lives were this legal. You mentioned earlier safeguards. What kind of safeguards are we seeing as states pass these laws?
Well, yes, the Oregon model has been replicated and expanded upon in some cases in California, in Vermont, Washington, where, first of all, just a brief process. You have to be an adult. You have to be a resident of the state in which you're making the request. You have to have a terminal diagnosis that two doctors have said will end your life within 6 months. You have to make two oral requests at least 15 days apart, one written request where your signature is witnessed by two people, one of whom cannot be anybody that is going to inherit from you, and no doctor can be the witness, either one of the doctors. If either one of the doctors believe that you are severely depressed and not competent, they can insist upon a psychological evaluation. And then the big hurdle, really, if you go through that whole stage, which is very emotional and very time-consuming, you have to make the decision as to whether or not you're going to get the medication as prescribed by your doctor and when you're going to take it. And I think in my more than 20-some years now of being involved in this movement, that is the most difficult part. And when you say, when the opposition says there's pressure, and they use the phrase, it's a duty to die, not the right to die, it's unfortunate. Because in my years of working with people, and I've worked with over 1,600 people who have made the request, and over 450 who actually used the law when I was involved in the organization, it's the exact opposite. It's the person who is going through the dying process who has to plead with their loved ones, please allow me to make this decision. And the loved ones are saying, no, 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 take one more chemo, one more radiation. I hear of this special drug down in Mexico or up in Canada, whatever. They want them to live. And, of course, it's totally understandable. They do not want the dying person to end their life any sooner than possible so that they can keep them. So that fear, which was probably legitimate 25 years ago when we first started talking about it, but when the data came out, it was obvious it was false.
I want to follow up on one point you mentioned there, one part of that procedure, that six-month prognosis for a terminal patient. Some advocates for this right to end-of-life aid say that's not a good requirement because these are imprecise numbers. 6 months could mean a month. It could mean a year, and it could be that somebody is too incapacitated too soon to make this decision if there's that six-month window.
The reason we chose 6 months, and again, Oregon is the model, we chose it very, very carefully, and we based it upon hospice enrollment. To be enrolled in hospice care, you have to decide that you're no longer going to get curative treatment, you're going to get comfort care. And we said, our goal is not to have people use the law. Our goal is to have people have a quality of life that is acceptable to them. And so if we can get them into hospice care, many, many people change their minds. But they find great comfort knowing that the option is available. So it's no different than having a physician say you have 6 months to live to enroll you in hospice. So that's why we chose that. And yes, on a bell curve, you will see some people not reach that 6 months, and some people live longer than that 6 months. But it's a skewed bell curve to the left, where most physicians are reluctant to give a short period. They'll tend to give a longer period. So generally speaking, if somebody has 3 to 4 months to live, they'll say 6 to 7 months, because they don't want to take hope away. And that's very important for people who are in that process, and I appreciate that.
You said that Oregon has had the Death with Dignity Act in place for 18 years now. In those almost two decades, have you seen the discourse and the discussion around this issue change in any significant ways?
Dramatically, dramatically. When I first started, I was the executive director of the not-for-profit at the time that facilitated the implementation of the law. We had in Oregon probably about 20 physicians who were willing to participate, and we had maybe 5 pharmacies that were willing to fill the prescription, and we had no hospices that supported. In fact, the religiously run hospices refused to talk to their patients about it if the patient brought it up.
We're talking
forward 10 years. 1,200 physicians participated, 500 pharmacies, and hospices now refer their patients to the organization that helps facilitate the process by educating people and showing them how to go through the process. So there has been a dramatic change. In fact, in the religious hospice, when I left, they were actually wanting to be present when the person. They found out, the hospice people found out, that the quality of life of their patients improved if they openly talked about the Death with Dignity process itself. So that was a significant change.
We're talking to George Amey. He's the president of the Death with Dignity National Center. It's been 1 year since the death of Brittany Menard, who advocated for aid in dying legislation after her own diagnosis of terminal brain cancer.
And we want to hear what you think. Has your opinion about this topic, aid in dying legislation, changed in the last year or two? If so, what changed it? Would you consider ending your life by choice if you had a terminal illness like this? Does this kind of legislation contradict, though, your beliefs? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with George Amey. He's the president of the Death with Dignity National Center. It's been 1 year since the death of Brittany Menard, who advocated for aid in dying legislation after her diagnosis of terminal brain cancer.
And we want to hear what you think. Would you support this kind of law here in Wisconsin? Would you want this option available to your loved ones? Does aid in dying legislation contradict your beliefs? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
So, George, you said that there are several states right now considering aid in dying legislation. Which states do you think are the most likely to pass that?
Within the next couple years, we anticipate the states of Maryland, also the D.C., actually, and then probably Maine, and then Hawaii, possibly New York and Illinois. Wisconsin is not on the short list, and I can tell you that we have analyzed that state. There is a groundswell occurring in Wisconsin, but it is not ready because of the legislative makeup of the state. Right now, we're just building in the state of Wisconsin, and the representatives who've introduced the bill recognize that, and we appreciate their building at this point, and it will take several years before I think Wisconsin passes it.
We'll go to our callers now. We'll go to Kevin in Huntley, Illinois. Kevin, hi.
Hi there.
Oh, what'd you want to bring up, Kevin?
Yeah, I appreciate what the gentleman has to say. I guess from my standpoint, I think that There are many examples of people who have been healed from cancers and different diseases that maybe doctors can't explain. I do believe that God can even heal people. I just am hesitant to give people that option right away because there may be other things that could happen.
Kevin, thanks for that call. And I imagine, George, this is an objection you get a lot, that hope may be very low, but there might be some kind of hopes. Why do we want to shut the door on that?
Right. And I can tell you in my years, people do not rush into this. Over one-third of the patients who get the medicine never take it, but they all find comfort in knowing it's available to them. The two-thirds who do get the medicine and take it, they are in the very late stages of their illness. No one rushes into doing this. First of all, the process does not go quickly or easily for a lot of people. Doctors who participate are very serious, and they want to make sure that this person's decision is based upon their own decision, no coercion, no mental illness, no suicidal tendencies, all of that. And then, on average, it takes about 45 days from beginning to end to get the medicine. And then some people, as I said, one-third never take it.
So, George, the caller did bring up the belief in God and that there are religious beliefs in not choosing your own time of death and the power of healing. How would you respond to people's concerns that this might be an infringement on religious beliefs if these laws are passed?
Yes. First of all, two reasons. Number one, I always tell people who have religious objections, I respect their religious beliefs. All I ask in return is please respect that I have the choice of my own belief. Secondly, we know that there is an opt-out provision. We specifically put it in the law saying that no one can go forward until they ask. And if they wish to opt out, they may opt out. Physicians, hospitals, hospices, nurses, anybody may opt out and not participate. So there is no sort of covert attempt to pressure people into doing this.
Talking to George Amey with the national organization Death with Dignity. Back to our callers now with Barbara on the line and Nina. Barbara, hi.
Hi. I agree with him. I do have religious concerns myself, but I also have a family member, a brother, who was diagnosed recently with bladder cancer, and he has been given less than a year to live. And as he's going through this process, he has been in so much pain. And he's losing mobility and balance and his whole way of life. And I think that he should have the right to decide if this is just too much for him, that he should have the right to choose to die with dignity and not have to go through continuous chemo and radiation and pain until his life ends.
Barbara, thanks so much for sharing your story, and sorry for you and your brother and your family in this tough time. And George, Barbara and her family not alone here, I don't think.
Oh, no. There's many people who are in that situation. And as I say, I respect people's religious beliefs, and at the same time, many people with religious objections or convictions that they never would want to participate themselves actually acknowledge that it should be the right of their loved one, whether that be a close relative, a close friend, or whoever. And I respect that, and we have always respected that.
So, George, one of the ways that suicide is treated is that often it is not covered under insurance policies if someone ends their own life instead of dying in another way. And there was a caller who wondered if aid in dying legislation does anything to make sure that someone who chooses that option, where it is legally allowed, if their family can then benefit from insurance policies in the way that someone who died in another way would.
Yes. Specifically, each law states that this is not suicide. for purposes of health insurance, life insurance, or any other forms of insurance. Therefore, in the almost 18 years in Oregon, not a single insurance company has objected. And they, and where there is a death benefit clause, they simply pay all of the proceeds to the survivors. There's never been an objection. Where insurance company also pays for medical coverage, there's never been any hesitation for the payment of that. So, no, we anticipated that, and that's why we put it in the law.
And, George, I wanted to ask, I understand you've had a loss there. Dr. Peter Rasmussen passed away this week. He was a leading advocate for death with dignity. Can you talk about the role he has played?
Dr. Rasmussen was probably one of the bravest individuals I've ever had the privilege to work with. I first met him in the late 90s when the law was going into effect, and he was a lone voice. He was one of those few doctors who was willing to participate, and he was in Salem area, which is a little bit south of, well, that's our capital, but it's about 45 miles south of our major metropolitan area of Portland, and there were huge objections to people in that area that did not want to participate. But he stepped forward, and he, as an oncologist, said, I respect my patients, and I want to give them comfort. And when I read the Hippocratic Oath, it says, do no harm, and I would be doing harm if I did not provide them with this form of comfort. And Dr. Rasmussen participated for years and years and years, and he is sorely missed. I visited him about 5 days actually last Saturday, and it was very tough for me, and I think for him as well, but I was able to say goodbye.
George, you mentioned earlier that the aid in dying legislation goes along with the hospice definition of being at the end of life, 6 months in a terminal illness. Are there other ways that you work alongside with hospice care?
Oh, absolutely. If you look at our data, first of all, more than 90% of the individuals who use the law are enrolled in hospice at the time they take the medicine, the lethal dose of medication. And that means that this is not an either-or situation. It's a situation where people are receiving comfort care. So we make sure that people are first informed. Do you know about hospice? Do you know about palliative care if you don't want to go into hospice? We'll direct you to those types of comfort care if you wish that. And sometimes people, once they get that type of quality of care at the end of life, even though they're going to die, their quality of care is acceptable to them, and they choose not to proceed with a death with dignity, but they still find comfort in knowing it's available to them. So, yes, we work hand-in-hand with hospice and palliative care teams.
George, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was George Amey. He's the president of the Death with Dignity National Center. It's been 1 year since the death of Brittany Menard.